Hello and welcome back everyone to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hello Mike, how you doing my friend? What's going on in your world?
Well Jeremiah, I have to admit something. Mike Bloom isn't my real name. I read it off the label of a toilet bowl. I feel like I'm a lie to the world, but you know what? I had to hide my face and name. I've done some bad things in my past, Jeremiah. I need to take on a new identity and flee to the East Coast.
So are you telling me that there is a toilet company out there called Mike Bloom and Sons?
I think it's called Mike Bloom and Sons, but the E got sort of scratched off in the moment. I couldn't make too many context clues. I couldn't play hangman while my life was literally in the balance. So I just decided to pick the first name I saw and ran.
There's nothing, you know, when you're coming up with a name to disguise yourself, there's nothing more than bending over a toilet, throwing up your guts, and looking at a toilet and deciding, you know what? I'm going to use the name off of this toilet. That's what I'm going to go with right there.
And the thing about Tad, and we're going to be talking more than a tad about Tad this episode, is that Tad is a writer. You'd think he'd be able to come up with good names like at the drop of a
yes.
hat. But instead he takes inspiration from like, oh, yeah, what's he's like, you know, doing what Kaiser Sose does at the end of The Usual Suspects. Like, okay, what's in the room here? Okay, Mr. Toilet. No, that doesn't work. Anastasi. Sure. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, because like you said, you could clearly tell the D had been rubbed off enough to where just the E was showing, but you would think you would realize that it was actually Dennis. I don't get it, man, but you're absolutely right. You would think a writer could come up with a much better alternative name than Anastasi, but wow, what a crazy way to to end the episode, to find out that's how he came up with the name. That was pretty funny.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
Sure.
It's I mean, a lot less crazy than finding out where Jack from Lost Tattoos came from, but it's definitely on the spectrum, right?
Yeah, that's good point. Yes, absolutely.
That's always going to perennially be on like the craziest side of the spectrum in terms of origin stories, whether it be name, bodily, you know, a bodily symbology, what have you. It's always going to be the mark to beat.
Exactly. And that's a sign of a great television writer, is when they could come up with stuff where you finally get the reveal and go, really? That's where did you come up with that? That's pretty great. So, yeah, that's a sign of a great writer. And yes, we will be, of course, covering episode 3, The Law of Non-Contradictions, and this season of Fargo, season 3, here on the Jay and Jack Network. This episode was directed by John Cameron, which I don't know if John has done any other episodes of Fargo. I meant to look that up. But it's written by Matt Walpert and Ben, I don't know how to pronounce Ben's last name, Nadivin, something like that. But Matt and Ben, of course, teamed up to write this episode. A very different episode. Mike, what did you think about your overall feelings of it? Because, I mean, a lot of people were talking about the fact that we really finally got to see Fargo go into another part of the world other than the Northwest. I mean, instead of seeing snow, we got to see palm trees and the ocean, which was extremely different from Fargo, right?
Oh, I love this episode so much for a variety of reasons. First, it highlighted Gloria Bergel, who we talked about this even in the previous episode. I think we were concerned as to how and when Gloria was going to interact with what's going on with the Stussy brothers, the actual Stussy brothers. They did not get their names off of toilets. That is purely bred and born. But we were wondering, you know, how is she going to get into the main action? Why is she so tangential? Even last episode, she was only in it for a couple of scenes. Now we have pretty much a Gloria-centric episode, which is very, very rare in Fargo, a show that prides itself on being an ensemble drama. I mean, I guess the closest thing I can think to it is the episode Lop Lop from season 2 was pretty much Peggy, Ed, and Dodd Gerhart. It was basically the three of them the entire episode. But even then, it was still, again, focused on three characters. This is really focused on one person's journey. In that regard, again, I can't help but make this comparison with Carrie Coon in the mix, but it feels very Leftovers-esque, where, not to spoil this past week of The Leftovers, but they also did a situation where they took a character who had sort of been on the fringe of the main action, put them in an entirely different location, had everything go wrong for them, and then they eventually either come back or they have sort of a revelation that allows them to continue on. So again, second week in a row, it's oddly lingering pieces of DNA between the two shows I cover on the Jay and Jack Network.
Yeah, I actually saw a lot of people talking about that with the comparisons, you know, especially, you know, with Coon being in both the shows and just so many similarities, which is really odd, because obviously the two different networks and two different writers, I mean, it's obviously just coincidence, but yeah, very, very eerie how that came about. But yeah, this was an extremely different episode. You're right. We have not had really an episode I can think of that did focus on one particular character, but it is something we needed. I mean, we definitely needed to really set the tone, and I was craving to learn more about Gloria, and I definitely got a lot of her, between her and, of course, the cute little adorable helpful robot, Minsky. I mean, I think the two of them, their journey of course leading to basically nothing in the end. I mean, that's what everybody's talking about, is this doesn't move the plot along really much at all, other than, of course, that she finds out how, of course, the late Thaddeus Mowgli, passing of his fake name, of course, how he came up with Innis Dussey. But I mean, outside of that, I mean, you know, it really kind of gone nowhere, which we knew it would. I mean, it was obviously going to be like one big red herring for the most part or something. I mean, she was not going to learn anything new as far as her investigation outside of the name. And but it still was so great. I really enjoyed this episode. It was very different. Very excited about digging it with you. Title meaning, I don't know, I guess we'll go ahead and bring it up since we've been talking so much about it. We kind of stray away from the game of bridge, which is great since the fact that we didn't see anything from Nikki, of course, and Ray. But this particular title, the Law of Non-Contradiction, Mike, apparently is the second of the third classic law of thought, which, of course, me and you, I mean, we talk about the classic laws of thoughts all the time, right? I mean,
I wish we did, because I feel like we break a lot of them.
Yeah, we do. This one, of course, states the contradictory statements that cannot both be true in the same sense at the same time, which shows like A is B, A is not B, are mutually exclusive. Now, a lot of people, of course, have been mentioning this, that there was many examples, and kind of, entire episode alone kind of really follows this law, really. I mean, kind of a big contradiction or non-contradiction. So, anything that stood out as, I mean, for you, it felt like a lot of, so much of what was going on really kind of followed along with that theme pretty well, right?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that really stuck out to me once you embellished what exactly this title meant was the conversation between her and Paul Moraine in the bar, her play neighbor, and tells this story about the bill of divorce, and that essentially, you know, a bill of divorce is what someone who's about to be deployed gives to their wife and says, you know, if I die during combat, this is our us officially sort of tending our divorce. So theoretically, it's sort of like a Schrodinger's cat scenario almost. I'm assuming he sort of falls in line with this rule as well, where because, you know, when the deployed person dies, then they're officially divorced. If he comes back, they're still married. So theoretically, during that time where that person's away, someone could be both married and divorced at the same time. And so that was the biggest thing that stuck out to me, just because in true Fargo fashion, it's this random anecdote or a little nugget of wisdom just dropped right plumb in the middle of the episode, like a big old duke that Officer Hunt would take in the bar bathroom. But it applied so much to this title.
Yeah, and for me, I thought that was actually a good one. That one was really, really in your face. You're right. That one was perfect the way that was set up. I also kind of liked the very subtle hints that you had many times for Gloria herself, where you could tell she still, the struggle she has with whether or not, is she the police chief? Is she not the police chief? I really thought that was nice because of a tie-in of this contradiction where, you know, like, well, am I the police chief or not police? I mean, like, she's really, it's kind of an inner struggle with her because she knows what's happening, but I don't know if she's even fully accepted it. But I thought that was kind of a nice touch. But yeah, we'll probably talk as we go through the episode a lot more about some other little signs that you had of this concept of this law. But very nicely done, as usual, in typical fantastic Fargo writing. And this season, or this particular episode, Mike, we get to travel back in time again. What do we think about that? 1975, where we get to see the very young Thaddeus Mobley at the Golden Planet Awards as he wins this big award, which, of course, we knew from the newspaper clipping from last episode that he had won this award. Now we get to actually be taken into that moment where he meets a producer named Howard Zimmerman. And Zimmerman, of course, begins by talking and convincing him that he really should turn this book into a movie. So what did you think about the introduction of the Thaddeus and Mr. Howard Zimmerman?
Yeah, so young Thaddeus, this was sort of going to be our players. It's so interesting that they really flash between these two timelines throughout. I mean, I was pretty stunned by the end of this episode that we got basically the entire Thaddeus Mobley mystery solved. On the erstwhile on Fargo segment, they made a frank mention of it, and I would think, like, okay, this is something that's going to be hinted at, you know, at various points throughout the season, and then we'll eventually stumble upon this big reveal. But no, they pretty much
the whole thing.
The pan. showed the clues first episode. Second episode, Gloria brought them up. Third episode, it got solved. I mean, I honestly cannot think of any other big lingering mysteries from Thaddeus, because the narrative we're going to see from Thaddeus itself is that it's typical, you know, star to be type of narrative where he comes to Hollywood, he's a successful writer, but he's going to kind of get conned into believing exactly what Hollywood is and kind of fall for its luster in a way from the Hollywood sign. Howard Zimmerman, Fred Melamed, I'm a big fan of him. I know he is a Coen alum. He was in A Serious Man. I know him most recently from his work in Maria Bamford's fantastic Netflix show. And he's a very good comic actor, but he showed himself to be he's a pretty sleazy persona as well. He's very good at playing sleazy, and we get this right off at the top. I will say briefly as well, going back to 1975, I feel like this episode is also sort of a microcosm of where Fargo has come as a series, too, considering that we're really straddling two timelines here, one in the 70s and one in the 2000s. And the first season took place in the 2000s, second season took place in the 70s. And I feel like what the show was really trying to say, you know, second season, I think they were trying to say, hey, we can create bigger stories. They included more characters, made things more complicated. Here, I think they took a step back, but this is kind of a way for them to say, we still want to play with this idea of storytelling.
Right. I agree. That's a really great point. And they do just a nice job, too. Even this episode, I was really impressed with the way they kind of transitioned from our flashback story to Thaddeus's backstory to what's going on with Gloria. I thought they really did a great job with that as well. So, very good point. And so the story, this cold open with this backstory with Thaddeus, it also leads to getting a really good feel about this poor guy. You knew this was going to get set up. Like, I had wrote in my notes that, I thought maybe he, like, big time con here. I mean, you see Thaddeus, he meets up with this Howard guy back at this studio, right? Joined by this very attractive woman named Vivian Lord, which is, love the name, by the way. Should we assume that she definitely sounds like she gets around? He gets around quite a bit. But after this very suspicious phone call, which we will say from Warren Beatty, Zimmerman explains to him that, you know, hey, we're going to need some money, you know, to grease some palms, you know, get some bribes going on here. He said, and of course, Thaddeus, as young and dumb as he is, offers up his book advance money. And we're off on the running for what's going to happen with poor Thaddeus here, as we see him writing checks all over the place, doing cocaine with this Vivian girl. Things are not going. You could tell this is going a really bad direction for this guy very quickly. He's taking cocaine, staying up late, trying to write the story. You can tell that this is not going to go well for him, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as soon as he offered that book advance, I knew that, like, he's being squeezed for all he's worth. But it is interesting to me that, you know, this is 1975, and I'm assuming one of the reasons why they feel like they were extorting him for money is that they thought that the idea of this space opera wouldn't work.
Right.
But 2 years later, look what came about. I was thinking for a second, you know, I know it didn't time out since I believe A New Hope was 1977, but I wondered, like, you know, what if it wasn't a scam? What if Thaddeus did put his money into it and Howard tried hard, but for some reason it got blown out of the water by Star Wars and it was the forgotten about space opera?
Yeah, that would have been interesting too. I mean, obviously, it sounds like that's not the direction they went. He basically just took him for his money. But a very good point, because, and it's funny because they purposely, of course, used that term during that phone call, the space opera, because as it came out down the road later on, where it was revealed that that was how it was kind of sold, as a space opera for Star Wars. So it was, the writers, of course, put that term in there purposely to kind of a nod to the fact that, hey, 2 years later, one of the biggest movies of all time, which, as me and you were recording on May 4th, the Star Wars Day, as everybody likes to call it, which is very ironic, right? That we're talking about.
Think we could have been recording this on Planet Y Day had the movie just gone through.
Exactly. I like this theory that what if he took it seriously and maybe this could have been that movie that was going to have been the most amazing space film, but then got overshadowed by Star Wars. I like this a lot. This is great. So yeah, apparently, I mean, it was pretty obvious right away that this is not going to go well for Thaddeus, that he was getting taken big time by these two sham artists, right? I love the transition where we get this animated sequence of Thaddeus' story, which was beautifully done, I thought, where we get the beginning story of this robot Naminsky that begins its journey looking for the meaning of life, and it translates very nicely into Gloria herself actually reading from the Planet Y book on the plane. And then, of course, as she runs into this gentleman named Paul, as we mentioned earlier, I thought it was really nice. So what was your feeling right away? Did you like this idea to tell the story, this Minsky story through this beautiful transition of animated sequences? I thought it was really well done. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely a little WTF at first, not UFO, but WTF, another three letters in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, this is something that Fargo has not done before.
Right.
They have told stories before, but they haven't told stories through this 2D animation. Though, again, it makes sense because this is Gloria reading from a book, and it needs to be starkly different to really differentiate that this is a different type of story than from what is being told. But then again, it's going to have ramifications, or it's really going to resonate with what's going on with the main narrative. I mean, I think the Minsky Gloria comparisons are fairly taut in that regard. But there's also, you know, there's other resonances there. I do feel like Minsky and Tad Mobius, and, you know, even connecting back to these in absentia Stussy brothers a little bit, are sort of all in this category of being exploited for their naivete. It seems like in all of these cases, you know, Gloria, I think, is a little more hardened. So I think, you know, I feel like someone like Officer Hunt could work over maybe a more naive person. But in all of these cases, especially with Minsky, you know, they just want to help. They just want to, you know, be right. Good people and do the best that they can. But you have outside forces around you that are leading you every which way and trying to attack you when your guard is down, that it leaves you a much more weakened person by the end of the trip.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I like that. And I did see all those comparisons when it comes to Gloria's story and, of course, Minsky's story. I thought the whole thing, though, was very well done. I did find, of course, for those of you who do not know, this animated sequence was done by the company called Floyd County. They do the production company that works on Archer, and they also worked on past FX animated series unsupervised. Unfortunately, I've only seen parts of Archer, but I have not seen anything from unsupervised. Are you familiar with any of that animated series?
So Archer, I'm about like a season and a half, and I got too busy where I had to.
Is it good?
Abandon it. I enjoy it. I think it gets even better as it goes along, but I was still really enjoying it when it started off. I mean, I'm a huge H. John Benjamin fan in general. He's a comedian who did the voice of Bob and Bob's Burgers.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
He also did Coach McGurk in Home Movies back in the day. I think he's great, but it features such a stellar voice cast, and I really like the writing. I just haven't been able to get into it. Though, again, speaking towards the audacious storytelling of Fargo, from what I've heard, not to spoil too much about Archer, but they make some very bold choices as well in their storytelling as the seasons progress.
Interesting. I like the fact that Alan Sepinwall had mentioned this to when the whole story of the Planet Myth was being played out. His question was, can we kind of start maybe thinking now, should every season from now on have some kind of UFO presence?
I think we have a mutual friend who would tear out his hair in frustration.
Antonio Mazzaro. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, because I think the aspects of UFOs being in Fargo aside, I think the UFO represents something interesting in that it is something literally supernatural. In season two, it was almost used as a deus ex machina. In this case with the UFO, it's going to be presented as Minsky's, you know, it's almost like Saint Peter meeting him at the pearly gates, proverbially speaking. They're telling him, you know, you've done well, you can now move on and receive benediction in a way. Your service, right. Your terms of service are complete. So, you know, if there is a UFO in every season of Fargo, at least they found different ways to use them rather than just have a UFO show up randomly at the climax of the season.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the idea about, you know, unidentified flying objects. I mean, the idea of aliens and UFOs is always fascinating to human beings anyway because of the unknown about it. Like, are we alone? You know, those questions we have as human beings as far as the unknown. And I think it's fine being presented the way it is. And you're right, they've done a nice job in this particular season, you know, talking about this story that this Thaddeus had wrote, which is a beautiful story about this android, this robot that has a bigger thing picture about society as a whole. So I think it's fine and I have no problem with it, but so as long as no UFO is distracting someone as they may have potentially have died, I think we'll be fine and we won't have to worry about upsetting our good friends.
Keep it in the story
that we don't have to worry about upsetting our good friends like Antonio Mazzaro. We don't want him to have too much of a heart attack as he binge watches season 3 of Fargo, which he told me he would. So now the next scene, it's a very quick scene. Gloria is getting dropped off, and apparently at a Hertz parking lot. But I wanted to point this out because a lot of people were talking about the fact that we didn't see anything from Gloria not being recognized by technology. But this time, she actually was recognized by technology because as she's walking by the cars, the car chirps as it when you hit the unlock button. Again, more things with Gloria and the relationship with her with technology. Very fascinating. Yeah. I just thought I would point that out, but I mean, I don't have no idea again yet for sure what this means. Any quick Mike Bloom takes yet on this?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to what we talked about last week with maybe it isn't Gloria, maybe it's the town of Eden Prairie. I mean, I think, if you live in a town where in order to contact your son, you have to get your deputy to pull him over in the school bus, I think shows how this town is sort of a little bit of a step out of time. And I know that Gloria was sort of the representation, again, as we talked last week about, she doesn't have a computer, you know, she really relies on the mimeographs and more handwritten elements when it comes to criminal investigation. But maybe it says that, in stepping into California, she's really putting herself in the modern age, and she's going to stick out like a sore thumb in more ways than one here. But right. Maybe it just shows that, like, hey, you're in a different place now. Technology actually recognizes you, but it's also representative of this entire place, which almost thrives on technology.
Yeah, that's exactly my thoughts as well, Mike. I thought it was beautiful to transition to such a small town like Union Valley, Minnesota, which, as you can imagine, you know, yeah, they know about technology, but they don't use it quite in the way that we have, of course, here in the LA area, which was a nice transition because, of course, we see her sitting in a car in LA traffic, which, as someone who's just recently moved to the not too far from the LA area and has experienced what it's like to be in LA traffic, I can sympathize with that. But yeah, that was one of the overlining things that I kind of really loved about this episode, since we have gone into a part of the world that we're not used to in Fargoland, which being LA, which is heavily, like you said, this whole area, of course, revolves around technology. So I thought that was, you're right, that was very nice look into this whole concept that maybe now that she's here in LA, that technology will recognize her. Maybe she shunned it because of her, you know, the way she is, but it's not ignored here. It's like, you know, it's like it's the chirping of the car means, hey, technology's here. It exists here. You can't ignore it. You know what I'm saying? So I like that theory. That really makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about this hotel, this motel, this crappy motel she checks in, which apparently has no view, but you can smell the ocean. I didn't realize this was kind of an LA thing. It's a joke. But the best part,
can you smell the ocean from your house, Jeremiah?
You know, I'm going to go ahead and be honest and truthful here. No, I cannot. It might be because I'm, you know, still about 40 minutes from the coast, but, you know, no, I cannot. So I guess this might be a thing. From the little I've read online, I guess this is kind of a thing when it comes to talking about LA, that you may not be able to see the ocean, but you can always smell it, I guess. Is that a thing? Maybe some of our listeners that have lived in this area a lot longer than me can fill me in on this whole thing, right?
Yeah, but I think we have more pressing matters to get to, Jeremiah. There is a convention in town.
Yeah, there is, a Santa Claus convention. Have you ever been to one?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really? Look at you.
In New York City and the New York City adjacent areas, every year there is something called SantaCon.
Really?
And it is the scourge of the earth when it comes to New Yorkers. SantaCon is basically an excuse for people to dress up like Santa and wear other Christmas-themed garb and essentially have them go bar hopping and drunkenly wander the streets of New York. As a New York resident, it is loud. It is raucous. I'm sure people have a great time, but I would personally rather board myself up inside than have to encounter people in SantaCon. So I didn't realize they had a West Coast division, but yeah, this is definitely not new territory for me.
Okay, wow. Look at, I had no idea, Mike. I had no, now does, when you go to one of these Santa, what did you say it's called?
SantaCon?
When you go to one of these SantaCon, are these Santas known for stealing people's luggage?
I mean, I think you'd be a little, you wouldn't be making the best decisions if you decided to bring luggage to SantaCon as it is, but I could totally imagine someone getting drunk enough to just abscond with somebody's luggage. And I will admit, as much as we might be saying a lot of mysteries were solved over the course of this episode, we never did find out. We obviously know that Gloria had her suitcase cleared out, but
right.
We have no idea what this one Santa wanted with all the stuff in her bag, which, again, considering that she doesn't use technology, there's probably no laptop in there, no iPad or anything like that. What exactly does she have that's valuable?
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly. I mean, for what all we know is the suitcase was full of flannels. That's all we know. I mean, so we know he got that. But what was he looking for? It's a good question because, you know, a Santa Claus that apparently loves the candy bar, whatchamacallit, what would they be searching for? And here's another question for you, Mike. Why the hell was her luggage so far away from her? Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I'm checking in somewhere or I'm in the airport, or that luggage stays right by me. I mean, I don't know what she was thinking. Maybe it's because she's from a small town in Minnesota where people don't steal a lot of things like this. She wasn't aware of the fact. Is that what it was?
It's exactly that. Yeah, it's why I think it was last week when they're saying, like, you know, oh, why didn't Anastasi lock his doors? Because they say, like, well, nobody locks their doors in this town. It's totally the same temperament. It's just what we were talking about before with the difference between small town bubble Minnesota versus sort of what's going on in the rest of the country. It's a dangerous place out there. I totally think it was Gloria depending on the kindness of strangers and saying, like, hey, if I leave my suitcase out on the curb, I don't imagine anyone was going to take it. I do think we'll talk about the whatchamacallits before. I think the whatchamacallit was from Officer Hunt trying to be cheeky. I don't know if it was from the Santa robber.
Oh, okay. That makes actually more sense because obviously he left a note as well. So yeah, you're right. And
it was one of his many attempts to make fun of her accent in an attempt to be cute.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. I didn't even really think about that because ironically, the next scene, of course, we do get introduced to Officer Hunt as she, of course, files a report about her missing luggage and then pries him for more information about Thaddeus. Right away, could you tell? I mean, did you know right away that he was a douchebag, or did it take the rest of his story narrative to realize how big of a douchebag he was. Because, you know, at first I wasn't quite sure. I mean, yeah, he's laughing at her accent, things like that. But I guess I could see that maybe someone that has probably lived in California his whole life, maybe he's never heard the northern accent that, of course, you brilliantly has displayed in this podcast many times. And I, of course, am still working on it, don't you know? But... what do you think? Did you know right away that this guy was that big? What a douche, right?
Don't sell yourself short, Jeremiah. You're miles ahead of Officer Hunt, so well, maybe you need to work on it a little bit more.
What a level to be at, too, to be miles ahead of Officer Hunt.
Well, so here's the thing for me. I don't know if you recognized him, Jeremiah, but Officer Hunt was played by an actor by the name of Rob McElhenney, who some people might know from the former FX show, current FXX show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He plays Mac, who is a big douchebag. And so I okay. thought he was totally cast for type. He's also the second It's Always Sunny actor to appear on Fargo. Glenn Howerton, Dennis, played the tanned-up instructor, if you remember, who was, I think, sleeping with Oliver Platt's character's wife, and who right. Lorne Malvo manipulated with that big, you know, Tate Woods like taped his hands to the treadmill and had him brandishing a shotgun to have everyone come in and shoot him down in that fantastic scene in the middle of the first season. So I definitely had a hunch from the beginning that this guy was a douchebag, and it really opens up the possibility for more It's Always Sunny characters to be in Fargo, though I don't know if Charlie Day is in Fargo. It's just going to open up a huge can of worms.
I was just going to ask you, is that who you want, or would you prefer Danny DeVito?
I want Charlie Day in everything, but Charlie Day also cannot play things grounded. So I feel like Glenn Howerton and Rob McElhenney are relatively normal guys, and they can play things pretty great when they want to. I mean, Robert McElhenney is also, he had a role in Lost as well. Glenn Howerton's done other stuff, but Charlie Day is just, even the way he talks, he's just talking like this. You know, he just talks like a little Bobcat Goldthwait. I just don't feel, I can't imagine that in a Fargo season.
It would be difficult for him. I mean, he could play off the clueless character, maybe, you know, that trope that we get from the Minnesota, you know, I have no idea, I'm just kind of there and I have no idea what's going on. He might be able to pull off that, but you're right. I mean, you think of him as a character as a whole. I think there could be some problems with him playing someone from the northern Midwest, but you never know. I know that there was some discussion about, actually a fairly big discussion about who should be the next person from Always Sunny on Philadelphia. But I of course would love to see someone like Danny DeVito. That would be great to get someone like him. And I could see him playing a role in Fargo, right?
I could absolutely see that. I think Caitlin Olsen would be great as well. I think she's killing it as the Mick on Fox right now. So she's got a lot of franchises to worry about simultaneously, but I think she'd do a really good job here too. I could totally imagine her in the, like, Nikki Swango, almost like, or the Simone Gerhart from last season role. Like, the person who's, like, kind of crapped upon perennially. That's kind of her role in It's Always Sunny. But maybe we're opening up the wormhole here. Maybe we're just inviting more It's Always Sunny people to just come onto the show. Though, again, we might be crossing a line if we get Charlie Day on here.
Yeah, that's a good point. Did you have any thoughts about the strange things that Miss Gloria had found in her motel room? A pair of men's shoes, it looked like, and a very mysterious, at first in my notes I put weird jack-in-a-box type device. Of course, so we did find out online, somebody had found out that the device that she had found in her motel room was called the Useless Machine, that was invented by a man named no less than Marvin Minsky, who was a computer scientist best known for his work in artificial intelligence. And of course, we all know the robot in Mr. Thaddeus' story is named Minsky. So any thoughts? I mean, the first thing I had was, wow, this thing is really eerie. But then, of course, you had the contradiction thing there, where the fact that you push the button and, of course, a little finger comes out and turns it back. So very interesting thought about that. But, yeah, that was kind of weird, right?
Yeah, I mean, initially with the shoes, for some reason I had this thought that, like, maybe we're going to see in the Mobley flashback that he left the shoes behind, but I imagine that even a hotel as negligent as this one would not leave shoes sitting in a closet for like 40 years. This is another mystery. I'm sure we're never going to find out who left the box in there, but I mean, it's also a representative of the eponymous law of contradiction, but I mean, I think it's also representative of Gloria's investigation in general until the very end of this episode, right? Where it feels like one step forward, two steps back. She feels like she's flipped a switch, that she's made a discovery. Someone's going to flip a switch right back and says, no, that's not right. To the point of where her whole trip is basically going to be invalidated when she finds out, like, oh, when she flies back and says, oh, yeah, this murder has no connection to Anastasia's previous history whatsoever. It was just this random crime by this ex-con who's now dead, Maurice LaFay. So it's a nice representation both, again, of the title of the episode, but sort of Gloria's struggle in this investigation that hopefully will not – it probably is going to, for story's sake, continue to happen because that's how we pad out six more episodes of this season.
Sure.
But you love Gloria so much that you really wish that she does well.
Absolutely, yeah. And you learn to grow and love Gloria even more in this particular episode. Now, the next scene, you already mentioned it, this whole moment where she decides to call her son Nathan and how, like you had pointed out, they had the officer Donnie had to completely pull over the school bus so she could talk to her son. Now, I know that she's not big on technology. I mean, it's kind of interesting that in 2010, I guess her son does not have a cell phone, is what we can assume from this, and she had to call Donnie's phone so he could then, of course, pull him over so she could talk to him. But great reputation as far as like the different levels of which, you know, you like you said earlier with LA versus Minnesota. I mean, these are very different parts of the world, and it was just very comical to, of course, watch this play out. And we also, of course, learned that the chief not only did not approve of her going to LA, but he wanted to remind her they're not even going to pay for this. Which is kind of funny because remember we left off, he said to actually take some time off. So it's like, you know, I don't know what he's complaining about. She's taking time off. She's trying to do an investigation about someone who sort of she was related to in a way, murder, and wants to learn more and has gone out to LA to try to find out more of Baxter. I don't know what this guy's complaining. I mean, he's really hard up for her, isn't she? Isn't he?
I mean, this is what we talked about last time where, you know, we were seeing that with new chief coming in, as Donnie put it, there was definitely going to be a disparity set up where, you know, he's definitely going to say like, hey, Gloria, you're going too far with this case. Let's just move on. It's a cold case. But, you know, I would agree. He said, you know, take some time off. I don't know. He would say, hey, hop halfway across the country and, you know, ignore my communications. I don't know. I think that's exactly how Mac would want to do things. He probably would expect like, hey, get some R&R, hang out with your son. So I don't know if he was exactly instructing her to go do that, especially without her communicating that to him as well. I think probably pissed him off. But yeah, she's definitely not getting off on the good foot with her new boss.
No, not really. But, you know, she doesn't care. She doesn't seem to be remotely concerned about it. And that's fine. That really kind of tells a lot about her, which I think we kind of all love about it. It's like, you know, she's like, you know, screw him, whatever, you know. Tell him that the ocean is wet. I love that line when Donnie says, what do you want me to tell the chief? Tell him the ocean's wet. That was great. So we really start to learn so much more about her. Now the next scene, we go to this diner. We get to meet the older Vivian Lord, which was a great scene here. She, of course, trying to get some information. Gloria's trying to get some information from her. She's not really giving it up, is she, Mike? She doesn't seem like she wants to talk whatsoever, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're gonna get this series of events where Gloria is going to try to encounter people from Tad's past, and they're just basically going to deny until they're pressed, and then they decide to admit things. And granted, Vivian's going to do it much later than Howard's going to do. Howard almost like immediately folds once she brings up details. But it seems like I was trying to figure out in the beginning whether or not they were doing it purposefully or whether or not, you know, it, as she said, I think there's a joke here where, you know, she said like, oh yeah, like that's not, that wasn't a very clear time for me. And Gloria says, which time? She says the '70s. It could be possible that it was just sort of in a drug induced haze. I can imagine yeah. this is sort of a scheme that Howard and Vivian would pull on a bunch of new kids breezing into town. So maybe she just honestly did not remember him.
I think so. You know, you think about it. I mean, if you're doing a lot of drugs and stuff in that time period, there's a good chance maybe she didn't remember him. I mean, obviously, eventually we do see her telling the story about what happened, but it's plausible. I mean, it is very plausible. It's a good thing. If you don't want to talk, it's a good thing to say, hey, say, listen, I was doped up that entire time. I have no idea who you're talking about. I don't know what's going on. Don't ask me. I get it. You know, I mean, she's probably a little bit afraid of her past. She doesn't want to bring it up. She doesn't want to talk about it. Totally understandable. I mean, eventually she does, but I get that. Now, were you aware of that the two actresses was a mother and daughter? I have to admit, I did not realize that until I looked it up. So
interesting. I wonder how that worked. Did they hire one and they said like, hey, can I bring on my mother/daughter? And they decided to do it.
Good question. I don't know. I did not see the breakdown as far as how that worked out, but I have a feeling that they purposely wanted to get Frances Fisher and Francesca Eastwood. I'm sure it was probably planned ahead of time, right? You would think so.
Yeah, hopefully.
I mean, it worked out beautifully. I mean, they both did a great job of playing this character, which was I could definitely see more of Vivian Lord. I don't know about you, but you know, especially the young version. But no, it was.
Do you want her to send you a signed photo then, Jeremiah? Apparently, she has plenty.
Yeah, she does have plenty. It's apparently all over LA, and now that I live here, I should try to look for it. Right.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's like every laundromat in the San Fernando Valley.
Right, exactly. Well, the next scene, Gloria, of course, returns to find her suitcase. We talked about this earlier, that the whatchamacallit bar was in there, a wrapper was in there, and of course a note from the just beloved Officer Hunt, which we get to find out what a piece of work he is as this scene with her and her meeting with him at this bar. Faces out. What do you think about the whole Facebook thing? I mean, obviously a lot of discussion online about this, you know, modern communication. I joke around about this a lot myself, about the fact that, you know, we live in a society now where he makes this big deal about how, like, physical communication is like, who wants to do that? Like, why would you want to do that when you can just talk to people online? So I love this notion where they talk about this. I mean, really, technology has changed not only the way we talk, but the way we communicate. Me and you, of course, doing a podcast that, of course, evolves around communication online, which is very ironic. So I like that. But, I mean, so much, of course, of this scene is really setting up what kind of character we're dealing with here and the comparisons between someone, here's a guy from LA who's into everything that's new and what's going on. And then you have a very innocent person like Gloria who, she's not really into that kind of stuff. So did you like the way Noah and the rest of the writing crew kind of tackled this situation and this subject?
Yeah. I mean, social media is obviously a big trademark of this day and age. Sure. And I'm also not someone to personally say that, like, oh yeah, we got dumber since we got onto social media. I personally feel like this podcast is a great example of ways that social media has been able to allow us to communicate with each other in unprecedented methods, which is fantastic. But what I think that this scene is providing for us is not necessarily that social media is making us dumber as humankind, but the fact that it's not necessarily making us smarter. If that makes sense. I'm thinking, for example, Officer Hunt being like, yeah, I have 352 friends. You know, he's basically admitting that he got catfished. I think shows that just because he's on social media and thinks he's connecting with people in ways you can't even imagine doesn't necessarily make him a smarter person. He still is falling for all the tricks in the book that I'm assuming he still would have even without the technology. The interesting thing to me was that he equated Facebook to like a small town, which yeah. It really is not. But again, making those comparisons between the main place in which Fargo takes place and that representation on the internet. Maybe we'll see that in more of a regard. Again, we really outside of Nikki loosely mentioning that she posted her bridge findings on her Facebook, we really have not seen that much social media in the main crux of our season. Maybe right. It's going to become a bigger part than we think, considering that small town comparison.
Yeah, there's so much, and we kind of blew past it about the fact that when, you know, Vivian was in the diner, everybody's faces were in their phones except for her, which is, of course, where we're at as a society. I mean, I notice that all the time, and I'm, of course, guilty of it myself, where you look around and, like, any moment that we have downtime, shall we say, whether it's downtime between a conversation with someone or you're waiting for something or whatever, you're probably communicating online with your phone or with some kind of piece of technology. And it's an interesting look into it. And I do like this notion about Facebook being a small town because, you know, for Officer Hunt, with 300 friends, you know, okay, that's his small town. I mean, it is a small town with you and your friends. And then we all, of course, know that Facebook as a whole is not even close to being a small town. Even in 2010, I think there was quite a few 100 million people that were on Facebook during that period. Of course, now we're, what, over a billion, I think it is? It's something outrageously ridiculous how many people mm-hmm. are on Facebook. So very interesting look. I love all that. It's, of course, been a huge big theme about, especially this season in particular, as far as like how things have is so different when it comes to technology. So now after we have this interaction, of course, with Officer Hunt, we do see Gloria runs into the passenger on the plane, Mr. Paul, which you had mentioned earlier with this wonderful moment about him discussing this divorce what did you call it? The soldier's bill of divorce?
Yeah, bill of divorce.
Yeah, which was great. I mean, it definitely followed along with the theme. And then, of course, Officer Hunt comes back and really kind of ruins things. Any other takeaways we cover from this part that we haven't already discussed?
No, I'm happy, as much as I love Rob McElhenney, that Officer Hunt was sort of one and done here. He was definitely using, for you Always Sunny in Philadelphia fans out there, the Dennis system when he was trying to come on to Gloria, and not in that regard. I'm trying to woo her, but yeah, I was a nice representation of the sort of the different men that she encounters. You know, you have someone who is very intellectual, much like Minsky, searching for life. He said he's been on, you know, 6 flights in 2 days, which is absolutely insane. But it's good that he's sort of wandering the world in search for some sort of meaning. Whereas you have someone like Officer Hunt, very content with where he is, and so blind to everything around him that it causes to be so pigheaded. So I'm happy he didn't follow her back from LA. I'll say that much.
Yeah, and I did mention it earlier. Ray Wise, who plays Paul, is always will remember him playing Ed Baxter, of course, on Mad Men, which me and you, of course, have discussed before on post-show recaps. But yeah, we
speaking of LA, by the way. How do you think this compares to, obviously, Mad Men took a lot of Californian trips back in their day, and that took place in a time even before the flashbacks in this episode. But do you find any comparisons between the Don Draper L.A. trips and the Gloria Bungle L.A. trip?
Well, no, I mean, the only comparison you can have is which we've already talked about before, is that when you live in that part, when you come to California, I mean, it is a very different place, and the attitude of the people, the atmosphere, the weather, everything is so different that when you get here, you do feel like you're in a, you know, a very special place, in my opinion. And I do think you kind of get that feel. So Gloria comes here. It's very different than Minnesota, just like Don Draper when he would came across, and you could feel that it was very, that he was in a different, very different place. And I do like that aspect that, you know, it is. When you come here, it's kind of hard to explain, but until you've done it yourself. But yeah, there is something different about the West Coast for sure. And but yeah, I didn't really put a lot of thought into it, Mike. But you're right. There is some comparison about the fact that, you know, Don felt very different when he was in LA compared to what he felt when he was at home on in New York, where he, of course, eventually really belonged. Spoiler alert.
Yes, even though he came up with a spoiler alert, his big idea while out on the West Coast, and I'll leave it at that.
True. But we all know he goes back home. He goes back where he belongs, right? Which, of course, you can all hear me and Mike's coverage on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, no, see, yeah, it's great comparison. So So yeah, where are we at? Yeah, so she returns to her room and finds another note. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring about these notes on the door, another, that's kind of a sign of old-fashioned communication, right? Instead of, like, being some messenger on your phone, this hotel, yeah, of course, yeah, probably because of the fact that it's a cheap motel.
And also the fact that she probably doesn't have a cell phone either.
That's a good point.
Did she call her son on a cell phone, or did she use the phone in the motel room?
She used the motel phone. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
No,
so
she does.
So they
not
probably
could
find another way. They probably would have, you know, called her room, or they would have called the cell phone number on file. But since she's off the grid, really doesn't have that. They decided to dust off the old, you know, urgent notice thing and just tacked it on. Because yeah, I've stayed at a good amount of hotels in the past few years. I've never seen that before.
Okay, I have to admit. I've been in cheap motels, and I've been in very fancy hotels, and I've never seen a note quite left like that on the door, but that's fine. I liked how it says, while you're away, but no, just some of the things that, you know, we had so much conversation about the difference between the way we communicate, you know, today as we did before. I just thought it was kind of interesting that, you know, both times she receives these notes, these old-fashioned type notes that you normally would have gotten years ago, left for her to let her know about a message. Now, of course, this particular one was about Chief Mack reminding her, hey, get your ass back home, again, pointing out the fact that he wants her back home. And we then get these another transition into this sequence where she starts to go through more portions of the book, and we get to see more of the android Minsky's continuing path as he searches through for a meaning of life. And at some point he gets attacked while he's charging his battery. He gets vulnerable and he gets attacked. Kind of sad moment for Minsky the robot there, right? It's kind of difficult to watch them just rip his other arm off or whatever.
And I got real nervous for a second, because what do we see as soon as Gloria narrates that, you know, Minsky has to recharge and is vulnerable to attack? Cuts to Gloria sleeping, and I thought for a second that,
yes,
again, the comparison between the two, that she was gonna get either, you know, kidnapped in her sleep, probably by that weird robbing Santa Claus, or something else was gonna happen while she was sleeping. But that's what I thought. I'm glad that I got that momentary reprieve and that nothing happened to her while she was recharging.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. It's funny you mentioned it. I did not have that reaction as well, but I should have. But luckily for her, she did not get attacked. She was able to get up the next day and go to the Writers Guild office so she can learn a little bit more about Thaddeus, and found out that he did work on a screenplay for Howard Zimmerman, which, of course, we all knew that. Now, we had this great moment. I mean, this woman, of course, that works at the Writers Guild, she's not a fan of her job. She was very annoyed that she had to look up some information about Thaddeus. Another thing too, a lot of people were talking about was the fact that on the screenplay, they had correctly spelled Y instead of having it Y like the way Thaddeus had it written with Y or W-Y-H. They actually corrected the spelling on the screenplay and actually spelled it out W-H-Y. Any thoughts about that? I mean, I just kind of assume is the fact that, you know, he was like, well, it should be spelt the proper way.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect representation of Thaddeus's general story of him being manipulated and essentially stripped of the essence of his initial work. I mean, granted, we did not see, obviously the Planet Y movie never came to be, but it would be interesting to see, you know, if Howard cared enough about the ruse to like put Tad in writers' meetings to have them be like, nope, get rid of this, get rid of that, you gotta change the title, because I think that's a good representation of what some creators go through when they, you know, bring things from the book medium into the movie medium. For example, changing the main title of your movie, you know, from there, they're pronounced the same but they're spelled differently, I think is a great sign of how manipulated someone can be by the Hollywood machine.
Yeah, it's a really, really good point. So, all right, so Mike, yeah, the next scene, of course, we actually get to meet Howard in present time, and things are going too well for him. He's in a home, apparently, and he looks in pretty rough shape, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is not Fred Melamed. This is clearly another actor. I'm glad they did not just put him in old age makeup and decide to see what would happen, but yeah, I mean, He's using a voice box. I don't think we actually saw Howard smoke that many cigarettes, so maybe the cocaine did it to him at some point, or maybe it was more so a case of the accident. Maybe the cane ruptured his larynx or something.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I mean, it was either that or just as time gone on. I mean, he's been in there for a long time, obviously. I mean, we find out, of course, eventually later what caused the accident. I mean, you know, Gloria, of course, questions about what had happened to him, and all she gets from the nurses is that, you know, well, many, many years ago he was attacked or had some kind of accident. That's all we, at the moment, had known about what was going on with him. But, yeah, he eventually had throat cancer, which is what I'm used to seeing when someone has a voice box. Or you're right, maybe the cane did attack his vocal cords. It's very possible. But yeah, he's in a very tough shape. She asks, of course, about Thaddeus. He just says, "Oh yeah, I remember him. He was a failure." Then, of course, he goes into this very interesting discussion about scientific theory. Now he says quantum something. Now, I don't know if he was talking about quantum entanglement or what it is, but this theory about, you know, particles being out there and then meeting, and then, of course, discussing was basically almost this long, nice way of saying, "Hey, I don't have anything for you. Get the hell out of here." Is that kind of what you?
Yeah, I mean, he finished it off so eloquently by saying, "Don't let the good Lord get you where you split you," or whatever the phrase is.
He's basically still a terrible person, is what.
Yeah, I think he's just saying that he doesn't really care and does not want to be very helpful. Yeah, exactly. He's not exactly a con artist still. Probably doesn't have the heart for it. But it's clear he's still not exactly a good person, even though Tad does not call him a bad person in the flashback, as we'll talk about. Yeah, I mean, I think the quantum entanglement thing is, again, typical Fargo of let's have these characters sort of pontificate on things that are much larger than themselves. And it sort of also pertains to this whole idea of, I think, just some of the random aspects that come out of life. And this always comes back to, we talked at the beginning of the season about how every season of Fargo almost starts as a miscommunication where a series of events happen in a certain way and two people happen to meet at a certain point of time that prompts things along. This season's case, Maurice loses the address to Emmett Stussy's home, decides to go for an E. Stussy. It turns out to be Ennis Stussy. Now Gloria is involved in the circle of it all. It just shows that sometimes, as much as you may think that, you know, oh, everything happens for a reason, sometimes it just resorts to random quantum particles bumping into each other, having a brief contact, and then briefly separating. The oceans rise, empires fall. We've been through it all.
Right, and it falls in great story with our friendly, sweet, little helpful robot, which, of course, the next scene we do return to his story, where he does, like you said, sees a lot of civilizations rise and fall, right? And it's just how life is, right? I mean, it really captures where we are as a society, I mean, as a civilization. I mean, how many times have we read that in history books, you know, about great civilizations and how they rise and they fall? I mean, you know, so it's a great moment where we see Minsky going through this long portion of time, only to eventually see his people return from him, apparently. And which I love about the fact that when his people, and I say people, but I mean whatever you want to call them, but when they come back, I love how they just go ahead and finish everybody else off, you know? It just starts shooting everyone.
Yeah.
Which
it's very Fargo-esque in that, like, lots of contempt for, I think we talked about this last week, when Sid tries to, you know, intimidate Ray and ends up, like, hitting some woman's car on the way out. Oftentimes in these Fargo seasons, the biggest casualties come from just the innocent bystanders. And so that seems like very Fargo-esque of like, you know, we got what we wanted done. Might as well mow down all these witnesses so we don't have to deal with any sort of paperwork.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a very, very good point. So now we do see Gloria, of course, getting a message from Vivian that she wants to talk. And that leads into this great transition of telling us basically this story about what really transpired, what caused this accident, what was this big moment where, poor Thaddeus, he returns to Vivian's room, only to learn, of course, that he was scammed. Now, I love the fact that these two were not, they didn't really sugarcoat it, they didn't really hide it all. They basically just said, "Yeah, we used the hell out of you." I don't think this is a really smart move to make on anybody. Even if you don't think that Thaddeus is the kind of person who is going to attack you with a cane, why push him? You know what I mean? Now, I do agree that she was probably the worst here at this. I mean, I feel like Howard was trying to be careful about what was said and what wasn't said. She really kind of took him over the edge, but it was just, it was crazy to watch. And then, of course, he totally blows up on him and just beats the hell out of him with his own cane, which is, you know, that's a rough thing to happen. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I ever start using a cane, I really hope someone doesn't use it on me. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the price you pay for using a cane when you're that young. I mean, I feel like Fred Melamed is like, Steve, you could say Howard Zimmerman might have been in his 50s back then, but still, maybe not the most usable fashion choice in terms of it being used as a blunt object to your disadvantage. Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason why they were so cocksure about talking with Tad is because I think they feel like they broke his spirit enough that they just sort of gave it to him the way it is. I mean,
yeah,
Howard was very matter of fact about being like, yeah, you know what? This is the way the world works. We taught you a lesson, actually, so you should be thanking us. I really don't
think
we're
doing you a favor, kid. We're doing you a favor.
Yeah, I don't think he was necessarily like digging in the knife. I think he was just more saying like, hey, you know what? This is the way the world works. And one of the things I love about Tad blowing up, aside from a shot in Freud perspective, that this is the guy we followed in down the path of despair, and then to have him, you know, really have Howard get his just desserts. But then he still cannot be a complete violent badass, right? Because instead of some sort of cruel or cool line at the end, all he tells Vivian is, you're a bad person. And then he has to run off.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could tell this is not the type of person. Like, I'm sure this was very uncanny for him to blow up. I mean, he let his emotions get the best of him, and he took it out on Howard Zimmerman. And I think that luckily for Vivian, he is still sort of a gentleman that wasn't able to capable of doing harm on her, even though maybe he kind of wanted to. He just left her with, like you said, the saying of, well, you're just a bad person. But yeah, I think you're right. I think they read him in a way to where I don't think they were expecting an attack. They felt like that you're right. They could be completely honest with this guy. He's like, listen, dude, you know, we're doing you a favor here. I mean, and they read him wrong. I mean, obviously, he still made an attack, which is, you know, obviously, I'm sure it's something that he regrets the rest of his life and he has to live with. But it was very Fargo-esque to have that whole play out where, you know, he took the cane and starts beating him like, oh, shit, man, that's pretty, like, whoa, holy cow, that was great. Really enjoyed that.
We haven't seen any like intense Fargo violence in an episode, so I'm happy we had that back. Even though it only dealt with, you know, we didn't have any Stussy brothers involved in this perspective. It was just a man who would later change his name to Stussy.
Exactly. And when we do eventually peer in and realize that we're kind of getting the grasp of the story that Vivian is sharing with Gloria. The biggest thing, obviously, Gloria has her aha moment where she realizes, wow, this whole thing really has nothing necessarily to do with the murder, which is great. But I liked how the fact that Vivian, she was very clear about the fact that even though, yes, you know, that was very right on. I was a bad person. But he wasn't that great neither. And I'm assuming she was talking about he. She wasn't talking about Howard at that moment. Did you feel like she was talking about Howard or Thad?
I think she was talking about that, and I think it's representative in the next flashback scene we get, what we mentioned before about, you know, how Thaddeus gets the name Anastasi, but he has literally blood on his hands. I think, you know,
I mean, is that what makes him a bad person, because he attacked him? I mean, is that what she's basically getting at? Okay.
I think what she's getting at is that, unlike what I said about Fargo during our preview show, the world does not exist in the world of black and white. Right. There are just many, many, many shades of gray. 50 shades of gray, if you're into that type of thing. But I think that she's just revealing that, like, yeah, I'm a bad person. Dad's a bad person. The police officer's a bad person. The local priest is a bad person. We're all just shades of how bad we are as a person. Nobody is absolutely perfect.
Right.
And so it's her way of kind of just, I think, commenting on the general temperament of society that we're all capable of doing not so great things for a variety of reasons. But that's just sort of, again, the way the world works.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've already talked about how, of course, Thaddeus goes back to his room and, of course, has this moment where he's throwing up and he sees this name. He decides, obviously, that's the name he's going to go with when he goes on the run here. Do you think it was too corny for them to have Gloria staying in the same room? I'm okay with it because it kind of sets up. She has to, of course, see the name on the toilet, which, of course, is going to lead her to the fact that, oh, that's how we got the name. That's where the name change came about. So I'm okay with it. Was it a little corny for you? I mean, were you okay with this? Her being in the same room?
There's a little contrived, but at the same time, I think Fargo can be a little bit of a contrived show sometimes in order to create good television. So I thought it was a nice poignant moment for her to, you know, bend over the toilet similarly, though for different reasons, and to see that. Is it completely coincidental that she was staying in the same room as Tad? Absolutely. But I think from a storytelling perspective, again, drawing the parallels directly between the two timelines, I think it's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I was okay with it too, but I understand why some people might have thought it was a little bit too much, but that's fine. Obviously, one of the big thing to think about when you see this is that, as we kind of mentioned before, is that poor Thaddeus would still be alive today. Enos Stussy would have still been alive today if another name was on that toilet. That's the big irony of the whole thing is that, and this is, of course, perfect for the way Fargo likes to tell stories, is that this poor guy decides to go with Enos Stussy because he sees Dennis Stussy and Son's toilets, and that's the name he goes with. If you go with any other name, and like you mentioned earlier, the guy is a writer, you think he could come up with a cool name to go with, but yet he goes with this name, and that eventually leads to his demise, which, call it irony, call it karma, whatever you want to call it, but it's pretty funny that whole thing leads to his death because he goes with that name. It's pretty funny, right?
Any chance you think Dennis Stussy is the father of Emmett and Ray Stussy, or do you think, again, it's just too coincidental?
That would be extremely coincidental, and I think I could see some Fargo fans being very upset if that becomes the case, but yeah. let's hope it doesn't go down that road, but that it was interesting. You know, he could have. So what if he would have? It would have been American Standard toilet. Would he have gone with American Standard? I mean, that doesn't seem like a name.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we do have Emmett as the parking lot king of Minnesota. I'm not sure if that's a title he inherited from his father. Maybe his father was the toilet king of the United States. I'm not entirely sure. So we'll see. Maybe there's a connection there. Maybe just like Thaddeus changing his name behind this pure finding, it's just something that's completely random and out of the blue and will have no connection whatsoever.
Well, we've already had a lot of shots. We've discussed a lot about pee and urine in this this season of podcasting.
Yeah, very true.
Officer Hunt mentions, of course, the beloved kids going in the pool phrase, of course, which we all know means they're taking a dump. I mean, there is a lot of references to toilets. I mean, a toilet is an important piece of equipment that is in our homes and in our businesses that, you know, we need, Mike. I mean, it's important to have, and a name behind that toilet is very important as well, right?
Yes, very true. Maybe we should stray away from the toilet talk and finish this episode.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe that's where you wanted to go, but all right. Now, we do finally close out Minsky's story. Very sad, right? I mean, you know, he realizes that he has many years of service and data would be very much appreciated, but could you please go ahead and shut yourself off with the switch that looks eerily like the switch, of course, that we see in the mysterious box that Miss Gloria has a infatuation with and winds up keeping, as we see at the very last scene of the episode. So that closed out the story for Minsky. We've said a lot about it. It does capture a lot about society and this theme about that we've talked about this season. Anything else that you want to add as we saw this story close out?
No, I mean, Gloria is going to hang on to the box afterwards, as we're about to talk about. Maybe it'll become a more use. Maybe we'll see more works from Thaddeus Mobley. It is interesting that amongst all the books that Gloria found, the Planet of Y is the one that she immediately picked up. I could definitely see for the future, some more devices of Gloria narrating a Tad's original, and it showing whether through some sort of animation style or not, having it pertain back to the action proper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, we could jump right into it. I mean, so obviously after we close out this beautiful scene with the animated sequence with Minsky's story, we see that, of course, Gloria's back home. You see her on the flight. I love the fact that they did highlight the fact that, because going there, they mentioned the fact that it's Christmas time. So we know it's in December, and it's 72 degrees. And then she comes back home, and what was it, 23? Are they busky? A balmy 23 degrees. She comes back home. They do have a funeral, of course, for Ennis, where her and only her and her son, of course, go to. How sad is that, right? Donnie shows up and, of course, wants to discuss the discovery about the perp, Maurice, of course, that we all know is they think is Russian, but he's not Russian. And we hear them discuss about how they're going to go to Arby's, and we do find out, of course, Gloria keeps the useless box or the useless machine. Thoughts on this? Any reason you think that she's keeping the useless machine?
I mean, I think it might just serve as a representation for her about how sometimes she may feel like dead ends in an investigative trail might be the end of her, but that she's just going to keep coming right back to try to flip that switch, and maybe she's going to try to work to overcome flipping that switch. I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, I don't think she imagined that, oh yes, the switch in Minsky's head is just going to be like, you know, the switch that I encountered. Maybe this is sort of, again, going into her inner psyche, why she imagined those two to be the same thing. It just might be a memento as well for her time, considering that everything else from her got stolen in L.A. I'm not entirely sure at this point, but maybe that's just because I have Arby's on the brain.
That's true. It might be. And that was my other question for you, is does FX have a secret product placement deal in place? Because apparently the Arby's has been mentioned in other shows as well. I mean, were you thinking Arby's? I have to admit, I was thinking Arby's after the show had ended. I almost went out and bought one as soon as I was done, but it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. So by the time I finished my notes, so all my Arby's were closed.
That's like a good time to have Arby's. I told you this before we recorded. My wife and I actually got Arby's yesterday afternoon before the episode even aired. So maybe that was just our predictive thinking. But Arby's, it might be another FX shows, but I feel like this is a direct call out to the movie, right? This is where Marge Gunderson and her husband eat Arby's. I'm trying to remember if that line to Donnie about how, like, why do you always show up when I mention Arby's? I feel like that was said in the movie. God, I haven't seen the movie in a while. I feel like it was a line in the movie, but maybe I'm incorrect about that.
Yeah, I have to go back and do some research, but I do remember something with the Arby's. I don't remember all the details, but yeah. There was a lot of course tie-in. There's so many tie-ins. The thing is, oh gosh, Mike, I read online, and there's so many great tie-ins that with this show, and Coen Brothers aside, I mean, their whole entire piece of our work. I mean, even this one alone, they had the Hudsucker proxy about a naive young man who gets involved in business where he wants to meet and gets duped. And then the Barton Fink, which I had not seen, but apparently is about a writer who moves to L.A. Or moves into a L.A. hotel and tries his hand in screenwriting. So many different little tie-ins to the Coen Brothers pieces of work that, but most of it, of course, does have tie-ins with the movie, and I guarantee you're right. The Arby's thing alone is definitely something that's kind of more of a tie-in for that. But it works. You know, I'm telling you, if Arby's did not pay for this spot, they should have, because I was thinking about Arby's afterwards, and I'm sure at some point in the next week or so, I'll probably get Arby's because of Fargo. So, but it's a solid episode, Mike. It sounds like me and you both really enjoyed this. It was a nice, different pace, I thought, even though it felt tonally like an episode of Fargo, but it was great to, like you said, have a central central episode where we talk about one particular character. We really get to know a lot about Gloria, which was great, and Thaddeus, of course. And I just enjoyed it. I really did. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it shows, again, what Fargo can do and how it can sort of stretch its own limits of storytelling. I thought it was a very strong episode, even though it does benefit from having an ensemble and concentrating on one character specifically. We were really able to chart Gloria's journey and stay only with her throughout the episode, which I think was very worthwhile. And now as a result, even though people again may argue, oh, nothing really happened, she's now on the trail of Maurice LaFay, which is going to lead her inevitably, I feel like, to Ray Stussy. And now we're sort of going to get things in the mix. I know Brendan Fitzpatrick had talked to us over the weekend about this thought that in her conversation with the gas station attendant last time, she had misinterpreted the term Russian for the nationality Russian. He thinks there might be a possibility that if VM Varga, for instance, is involved with overseas operations in addition to his involvement with Emmett's organizations, maybe that's going to lead her down that trail as well. I'm not entirely sure if I'm willing to make that leap. I think that'd be a cool thing, but for right now, it seems like she is heading towards Ray.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, and it's she could have gotten there without having everything that she learned, but it was a great episode, and I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I did enjoy our little conversation with Brendan Fitzpatrick, who of course a longtime listener of many things that me and you have worked on before. We really appreciate the fun conversations back and forth, which of course many people can hit us up anytime, of course, on Twitter. Now, before we give out and close out the show, give everybody information about where they can get a hold of us and all that good stuff, I did want to point out real fast, did you catch online? Apparently, I don't know why I didn't miss this. I don't know how long this has been out, but apparently VMVarga.com is a real thing, Mike. Did you happen to check it out?
No, I am now directed to a page that has a big eye on it, says click to download information.
Now, don't click it, Mike. Don't click it.
I've learned my lesson
forever.
From Irv Blumkin. I do not want a Black Mirror horror to be carried out anytime soon. But it is real. I would encourage people to check it out, maybe with a virus protector enabled.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will spoil it. There's one thing I could say immediately would spoil the whole thing for a lot of people. And I don't want to do that, Mike. And I'm sure you probably know which term I'm referring to. But I think it's worthwhile as fans that you really need to check it out. But be careful. We don't want you to have your complete entire network system wiped out completely, right?
Absolutely not.
But just in case, I'll go ahead and I'm going to give the link to our wonderful Colleen here at the Jay and Jack Network. And you know, go ahead and have her include it into the show notes, you know, just in case you forget. I mean, like I said, it's very simply VMVarga.com. Again, don't go there, people. We don't want you to have any viruses, but it is a thing and it's out there. And I just want you guys to be aware of it. Mike, why don't you go ahead?
I like how we're giving this site like so much free publicity, but not only advertising it, but telling them explicitly not to go there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, we don't want to spoil it for anybody, but maybe next week at the top of the show, we can mention what we found when we went to VM Varga. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, Mike, why don't you close that show out? Why don't you tell everybody how they can follow us, and maybe you could tell a little bit about the wonderful stuff here on the Jay and Jack Network that they can check out and how they can help support the show.
Sure. So you can follow us on social media, specifically Twitter. Jeremiah and I are both very active on Twitter. Jeremiah is at Jay Panhorst. I am at a Mike Bloom type. So yeah, as we talked about before, we'd love to talk with you guys about anything Fargo, your own theories, thoughts on the episode. And while you're here, check out all the other great stuff on the Jay and Jack Network if you have not yet. We've got coverage of The Leftovers, which I hopped on with Jay and special guest AJ Mass this week to talk about another polarizing episode that, as I mentioned in the very beginning of this podcast, also deals with a character traveling to a strange new land and focusing exclusively on them. You can also check out The Married Man Show, the broadcast, Survivor coverage. It's all popping there on Jay and Jack. And if you are going to be, at the time this is being released, at the annual gathering in North Carolina this weekend, I will be there as well. It'll be my first time there as part of the Jay and Jack crew. I'll be recording a live Leftovers podcast with Jay and Jack Sunday night. Would love to talk Fargo with you. Would love to just get to know you. One of my favorite things about getting to podcast are getting to consort and meet with a variety of listeners from a variety of lifestyles. And I would be fortunate to get to meet you and talk any sort of nerdy television with you. And if you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed to the Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike feed on iTunes. You can search just that, Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. And while you're there, we're always appreciative of ratings and reviews, especially this early on in the season. That's going to bump up our spot in the iTunes chart. So any feedback is greatly appreciated. And as always, thank you all for listening.
Absolutely. And thank you, Mike, for blessing us with the brilliance that is Mike Bloom. You did an amazing job, as always, to break down this episode.
I'm no Thaddeus Mobley.
You know Thaddeus Mobley, but that's okay. You are our Thaddeus Mobley, and we appreciate you coming on with me, man. This has been a lot of fun talking to this episode. Of course, we'll be back next week to discuss the fourth installment of Seasons 3 of Fargo, which we can't wait to discuss. Hopefully, we will be able to take a break from some of the potty talk and, and
no
all
promises.
That stuff. So until next week, Mike. It's been a pleasure, and you guys, thank you for listening, and until next time.